Hello, everybody. Terrence Slayhew here with another episode of the Intellectual Agrarian Podcast, where we talk philosophy from the farm. Our guest today is Cliff McConville from Allgrass Farms in West Dundee, Illinois. Together, we discuss how he started farming from a background in the insurance business, building his on-farm store, raw milk in the state of Illinois, and much more. It was a privilege to get to interview Cliff at his farm and an in-person interview, so I hope you enjoy this interview with Cliff McConville. Cliff, welcome to the show.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thanks, T.
Well, starting off, I'm going to adjust the table here. We just finished a wonderful tour around your farm. Would you mind telling the audience, though, a little bit more about the farm?
Sure. So we're a very diverse operation, as you gathered. Right now, we have 120 acres that we're in production here, all of it that we lease, and we'll get into that, I know, a little bit later in the interview. But so our biggest enterprises on the farm are raw milk, and that's kind of our, for the most part, our centerpiece. Really, what we're known for is the raw milk production. We also do grass-fed beef, and I would say in terms of revenue, those two are pretty similar. and then probably next in line, we do a lot of eggs. We have, you saw, about 1,300 hens out on pasture, so that's a popular item as well. Pasture-raised pork, so we've got our piggies, and then we also produce, internally, the stuff we produce, we also do turkeys. We'll probably raise about 750 turkeys this year on pasture, about two-thirds of those for Thanksgiving, then a batch that we raise in the middle of the year for mostly for the store cut-up parts.
Yeah, I was talking with Anna in the store a little bit earlier about the turkeys.
Yes.
So when you just raise the ones that are kind of for the store, do you just do them as whole turkeys, or?
It's interesting what we found over the years. Nobody buys a whole turkey except at Thanksgiving. I mean, it's almost, I would say we sell a few for Christmas, but that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
So the group that we started raising, that'll be ready in the summer, we'll take those up to Hometown Sausage Kitchen, and they will cut those into, they'll smoke the legs, so we'll do the smoked drumsticks, and then they'll do the breast cutlets. Or breast tenders, I think is what they call them. And then we'll do sausage and ground turkey and wings. We'll sell a package of wings. But we sell, and that's very popular. In fact, that's, you know, we get people asking for that all year round. And so we'll sell a lot of those probably by Thanksgiving. So those
really?
250. Yeah, so that's been a very popular product for us to offer.
Yeah. I'd imagine. I mean, I love turkey, chicken wings, so
right?
Turkey wings just more to eat.
Well, you know, they do. They're big. They're much bigger, obviously, than a chicken wing. But when we had the wings, a lot of people use them to make, I think, like turkey stock and stuff because there's a lot of bone in them.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and some meat. So I think a lot of people were using the wings for that.
I've always been of the opinion because everyone does grass-fed or broilers. But turkeys don't get as much of the limelight in the sustainable ag community. Is there anything different to raising the turkeys on pasture than the chickens?
You know, I think what we've gotten better. Turkeys are a little harder to raise. They're, especially in the brooder, when we get day-old poults, they tend to find ways to die. You know, I think they have their reputation. So really, you know, we normally have to be a little more careful making sure, especially in the spring batch when it's colder outside, we got to cover those brooder boxes up every night, make sure that they don't get chilled or they pile up on each other. But once we get them out on pasture, we were looking at those mobile range coops. So now what we do is we keep them in the brooder for about 4 weeks and we move them into one of those mobile range coops for probably about 3 to 4 weeks.
Okay.
So we're moving them with the broiler chickens. Once they get about the size of a chicken, and then we put them out into the open pasture, you know, where they're, you know, just surrounded by the electric netting. It's kind of a day range system. And we found at that size, the hawks and stuff don't bother, the predators don't bother them as much. And they're pretty much, when they get big like that, they're very hardy.
I mean, they're almost indestructible.
Yeah, exactly. So we've had pretty good luck the last couple of years doing it that way. And the margins on turkey, because it's harder to find a pasture-raised turkey, we do feed them organic feed. You can't find that in the store.
Yeah.
And so people come to us and they're willing to pay a good price. So that's actually probably our best margin product is turkey, both the Thanksgiving, you know, the fresh whole turkeys as well as the parts. So it's really been a nice enterprise for us.
I don't want our conversation to just be about turkeys, but it's one of those things where I actually think I enjoy turkey meat more than chicken meat.
Yeah. Oh, I do. But I'm for sure like that, yeah.
There's almost no way of finding it grass-fed, raised organically, right, and on pasture, because popular demand, I guess, would be the thing. It really just doesn't seem to be there. That's one of the neat things about being able to find local farms, mm-hmm, is that you can find those more niche products that work, mm-hmm, that are fantastic and delicious.
Right, right. So, yep. So anyway, so we got off on the turkeys, but
yes.
Those are the things that we also produce, as you saw. So we have about 7 acres of vegetables, mm-hmm, and that is not something — I'm not a green thumb — so we outsource that to a vegetable farmer who, mm-hmm, essentially raises for our CSA boxes the vegetables as well as for the store. So our first crop, we do about 100 CSA shares a year. And so those boxes get filled every week first, and whatever doesn't go into the boxes, we sell in the farm store. And I probably didn't mention that we have an on-farm store, which is where we sell most of our product that we produce here. A couple of other products, we have one of our farmhands, Lucas, raises sheep here.
Okay.
So he's got grass-fed lamb, mm-hmm, and so we sell quite a bit of that in the store, and then he has some of his own customers that he sells halves and whole lambs to. And then you met Anna and Carolina, so they both have their own little gardens here. Mm-hmm. Probably have maybe between the two of them a couple of acres that they produce fresh herbs and flowers for the store. Mm-hmm. And so I just take a percentage of the sales of that, and they just kind of take care of their own portions of the gardens.
That's awesome. And what it is you, in the store you've basically created, you can get everything that you need for making the meal,
right,
in essence.
Right, right. Yeah, so the store — we opened the store in 2016, and that really — our sales really took off once we had the store available. For one thing, it was easy for customers. They could just stop in and get a package of ground beef or, you know, steaks, or, you know, once we got the license for raw milk — we'll get into that — they could buy a jar of raw milk. So we started to notice, hey, well, what else are people going to buy? You know, mm-hmm, obviously we have chicken, we have pork in the store. We raise vegetables. When we don't have vegetables ourselves, we also source them from other local farms. Mm-hmm. So we have some other suppliers. And then we started saying, well, what are other items that people are having a hard time finding in the grocery stores? So we got grass-fed raw cheeses here, you know, from Steckler Grass-Fed down in Indiana. We carry the Trader's Point yogurt and cottage cheese. You know, that's grass-fed, organic, from Indiana. So we kind of would try to source other items we think there's going to be demand among our customers for, and get those items into the store. Mm-hmm. And so that's been
great. And kombucha.
And, oh, yes. And which, as you —
I'm drinking the elderberry, isn't that
yes,
right?
Yes.
Which — and it's fantastic, by the way.
Yeah, so we've always had kombucha. I told you the story. We had another kombucha, local kombucha maker, and she went out of business or stopped making it. And so we're looking for another local kombucha, and we, you know, our store manager said, oh, we ought to try this Arise kombucha made in Chicago. And I'd always been kind of a kombucha drinker because it was good for me, but I wasn't, mm-hmm, really like in love with the taste of it. And once I had — in fact, the first one I tried was elderberry, and I was like, wow, this is like addictive. So, you know, not only do we have it in bottles, but then we had to get the kegerator, so we have it on tap, which is mostly, you know, to feed my kombucha addiction. But it's been good. It's great to have it, and it's been very popular. I mean, we look back at our kombucha sales for this March when we had Arise versus last year when we had the other kombucha, and our sales like quadrupled in kombucha. You know, it's made a huge difference. So having the best product is really, you know, makes a big difference.
That really is the, mm-hmm, key, because, like, I've had kombucha before. My family's made kombucha.
Mm-hmm.
This tastes more like a — It tastes like — I like drinking sparkling apple cider. That's
right.
My thing.
Yep.
This tastes more like a — it's a thicker, more like a lager almost.
Right.
I guess I'd
it's
say.
It's very robust.
It's very robust. It's complex.
Yep.
It's not just like, oh, yay, I'm drinking vinegar.
Right, right, exactly. That's my same reaction when I first tasted it. I'm like, whoa, this is crazy. I could drink this all the time. And pretty much I do drink it all the time. I have to control myself.
You've just got great gut biome.
Yes,
that's what it
exactly.
is.
Exactly. I look at it, I'm improving my biome every day by drinking some more of the kombucha. But so that was, you know, one of these things where we thought, oh, we were kind of sad because we're losing our local kombucha maker. And then we found another product that's really, mm-hmm, you know, has really been popular with our customers. It was kind of — part of it is, I mentioned, you know, we do a monthly newsletter, and I mentioned, mm-hmm, in my last newsletter. While I was writing it, I was drinking the kombucha. I said, this is the best kombucha. So we have a big newsletter list, and everybody's coming and buying it and trying it out. And so now we've got everybody hooked on it. So,
and a couple of things I want to point out for those listening is that, A, you have great access right now. You're on 131, right?
Yes, Illinois Route 31.
Right. Illinois Route 31, which means you have great direct access to people driving. And that's one of the number one things. I used to work with Royal Oak Farm, and bless their hearts, they've got a great operation. I love going there, but it is a trip. And they've had to figure out how to say in their marketing material is getting there is half the fun, because you have to kind of weave your way through some of these back middle-of-nowhere places to get there. And they have a great operation.
Yeah.
But it is so nice when you can have the store right there where people are, and they can just stop right in, and they can – I mean, since I've been here, I mean, I think the parking lot's been full since I got here.
Yes, yes.
And it's awesome to see that.
Yeah, I think, you know, I tell people, they say, man, you know, you guys have grown so quickly. And I said, it's a location, location, location. We have a location. We're right really sort of in the northwest suburbs of Chicago. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's housing subdivisions around us. There's a major mall, you know, probably less than a mile up the road, you know, and we're 2 miles off of the tollway. So when I first saw this location, part of my thinking of wanting to get this location was because I knew, man, this would be a great place to have a store, because you have all the traffic and the cars drive by every day. Thousands of cars drive by every day, and they see our cows and our chickens out there on the pasture. And they're like, oh, you know, I can stop in there. A lot of people drive by for years and they didn't know we had a store here. And you've noticed we put that marquee up that says store.
Yes, I saw that.
Because I can't tell you how many people would stop in. Oh, I've been driving by here for years and I didn't realize you guys had a store. And I'm like, yeah. So, you know, we probably could do a better job with our signage for sure. We're going to probably do a new sign. We've got that kind of quaint little wooden sign out there that's cutesy, but, you know, I don't think it draws that many people in.
it helps. It really does. And thankfully, we're reaching a day and age where more and more people are looking for those things when they are driving through somewhere where maybe they haven't been before. They're looking for that local place that they can stop by and visit. And I think regardless of whether people drive that road every day or they're doing it for the first time, something like visiting here is a great option.
Right. Yep, exactly. And I think, you know, traditionally, I know you asked me about before we had the store how we marketed, but, you know, we used to draw people and they would find us because they were looking for raw milk or they're looking for pasture-raised chicken or eggs. And so they would find us on the internet, and then they'd drive out, you know, when we used to sell out of the house, and they'd have to make an appointment, and it was kind of clunky.
There's more resistance in the
process. Right, exactly, right. You know, and so once we had the store open, and we had, you know, every day the store is open, which is kind of a heritage to our raw milk herd share program, but it makes it so much easier for people to come in. They can stop in whenever, and we do get drive-by. You know, drop-in customers now, where we did never have that before. When we were back at the farm and you had to drive through all these windy roads to find us, the only people that found us were people that knew we were back there, you know. So, like I said, that made a huge difference in our sales once we got the store open here.
So tell me a little bit about how you came to farming. What was it that prompted you? Because you were from Chicago originally. What made you say, you know, I just really want to chase cows through a field when they decide they don't want to be in the fence anymore?
So, yeah, so I am not a, I do not have a traditional farming background, you know, so we'll, I think, you know, for those that are interested, you know, if I can do it, anybody can do it. I'll put it that way. But so I worked in the corporate world for 20 some years. I worked in downtown Chicago, and I was in the insurance business for most of my career. And we lived in the suburbs of Chicago. I took the train downtown. You know, in the beginning, I used to wear a suit, and you know, I was climbing the corporate ladder. And you know, I was things were pretty well. I was doing well enough that we moved out to Barrington Hills in 1998. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, some of your listeners, that's kind of a semi-rural area. It's a suburb, but there's a lot of people there that have horse properties. Really, it's one of these kind of minimum 5 acres sort of thing. So, you know, it's 40 miles from Chicago when that area was developed back in the 50s. It was way out of Chicago, and then the suburbs of course crawled out and surrounded it. It was sort of an oasis, and we, you know, we wanted a little bit of land, so we found a place that had 8 acres, and you know, not a fancy house or anything, but it had a little horse barn. And so I said, oh, this is kind of neat, and I can still drive to town and take the train down to Chicago every morning. So I did that for years, and we just kind of had, we kept a couple of horses there, and then eventually we brought a few chickens, so we had our own eggs. So that was kind of the extent of my farming up until 2011. So what happened in 2011 was, well, preceding my venture into farming, I had I have a sister that lives out in California, Christy. And she's kind of a left-wing, you know, I was kind of a conservative, you know, Republican. I'm not like a staunch right-winger, but I was, you know, a conservative fiscal type guy.
And yeah. You were in insurance. It kind of goes
exactly,
with the territory.
Exactly, right. And so, you know, and I read the Wall Street Journal every day. You know, I had my stock portfolio and all that kind of stuff. And she's like, oh, you know, so 1 year for Christmas, she sent me Food Inc. And I think this was probably like 2008, 2009. And so I loaded it up, you know, interesting documentary. I thought, oh, yeah, you know, we really should be eating better. And at the time, I really wasn't conscious of it. I wasn't thinking about it that much. So then the next year, she sends me for Christmas again, she sends me the book, The Omnivore's Dilemma. So this time I'm reading it, and, you know, the whole first third of it is, you know, kind of about King Corn, I think, is really what they talk about. The what's, you know, we're essentially
walking corn
chip, you know.
Yeah.
And and then the whole middle section was all about, you know, him, you know, the author, Michael Pond, going out and spending a week at, you know, Joel Salatin's farm. And so I really was interested. Like, once I started reading about that, I'm like, wow, this sounds really interesting. And this Joel Salatin guy, you know, he wasn't on my radar screen before that, but then I, you know, went out and Googled him, and he was briefly in Food Inc., and I remembered him in Food Inc., and so I saw he'd written all these books, and I thought, oh, the guy's got all these books out there. So so I ordered a couple of his books, you know, Pasture Poultry Profits, and I think the Salad Bar Beef were the couple of books, and I was kind of reading through them, and doing my daily commute and thinking, oh, I've got 8 acres behind my house that I'm really not using, you know, and these horses are really, you know, I think we were down to one horse and he was like 30 years old then, and we couldn't ride him. He was blind. And I'm like, you know, maybe I should be getting some cows or chickens or something out on those 8 acres behind my house. So I was kind of, it was kind of the back of my head that maybe we should start playing around with it a little bit, at least raising food for ourselves. So that year, I ended up getting a job working out of the house, you know, an insurance job again. But now I was no longer commuting downtown. I was going to be working out of my house, and I had a little office in the house. Like, oh, that's going to save me like 3 hours a day. I'm not on the train. I'm not, you know.
Driving to the train.
Driving to the train, going from the train station to my office building in downtown Chicago. And so I said, you know what? I think it's time for me to, like, raise some chickens. So I went out and built a Salatin shelter, you know, the little chicken shelters, and I ordered 25 broiler chickens, and I was pulling that little thing around my backyard. And I went and bought 4 beef calves, you know, that summer of 2011, and I had never raised a cow in my life. So I'm like, all right, you know, how hard can this be, really? You know, they eat grass. I got grass. I already had fencing from the horse pastures. And so that's kind of how I got started, that was 2011. And then I said, you know what, if I want to maybe get a tax break, because some of my neighbors were like, oh, you know, can I get a half of that beef when it's ready?
Yeah.
Or, you know, so they started asking for eggs and stuff. I mean, we already had eggs. We probably had 20, 30 egg-laying hens. That's kind of how the business got started. Really, there was no intention to become a full-time farmer at the time. I just was thinking that maybe I would do this kind of as a side gig. And so that's really how we got started. So what I remember, we put a website together. We didn't get any hits until 2012. And what happened in 2012 was, I don't know if you're familiar with Eat Wild.
Yes.
And Jill Robinson.
Uh-huh.
So I had read her book, Pasture Perfect, which was a fantastic book. And I saw where she had this. We got our farm listed on her website, and there was probably, if I recall, 30 or 40 farms at the time that were on Eat Wild in Illinois, and she lists them by Illinois, but the other thing she does is she lists them alphabetically. And so at the time, my original farm name was Barrington Natural Farms, you know, because we're in Barrington, and of course B is at the top of the alphabet. So we were probably the second farm. I think there was like an afterthought farm or something. So I just remember the day that I got that she posted our listing, and you have to kind of apply, and she does a little bit of screening of them, but
Betty,
the day that she posted the listing, all of a sudden we started getting orders, and we didn't have an online order. It was kind of like a You could print out an order form and fill it out and fax it back to us or email it. You know, it was pretty low tech, you know, at the time. And all of a sudden, I'm getting all these orders for, like, chickens, which I didn't have at the time, and for pigs, pork. I didn't have any pigs at the time. And I'm like, oh, my God, I'm going to have to get more land and, you know, more livestock. And so, you know, all of a sudden, I started thinking, wow, this could be a real business. You know, at the time, up to that point, I was thinking it would just be kind of like a little side thing that I did along with my insurance, you know, job.
Yeah.
So that's really how I got started. You know, it was really, and I would say ever since then, that was the spring of 2012, I was running, like, every day to keep up with the demand. I mean, the demand was far outstripping for the first 4 years my ability to produce enough product to meet the demand. So so it was kind of, in some ways, a good situation, but it was always, I was one of these people that's, I hated to have an unfilled customer, you know, that was wanting something that I couldn't provide. One of the smartest things I ever did was, you know, I didn't know a whole lot about e-commerce. And so one of the guys that did know, I was asking him, I said, you know, all these people want stuff and I just can't fill the orders. He said, you know, what you need to do is you need to capture that information. I said, we're getting all these hits to the website. He says, on every page of your website, what you want to do is capture their email address, have a sign up for your newsletter. It should be on the top half of every page of your website. In fact, I put it up on the header. We had just a little home design website. And sure enough, that was the best thing I ever did, because we were getting, you know, some days I would be getting 12 people signing up for the newsletter. We were getting so much traffic to the website. And so we were started capturing those emails, and then I started writing a monthly newsletter, almost monthly, because there were some times that I missed a month, you know, in the summer or whatever.
It happens.
Yes, exactly. But that newsletter list really was the backbone, I think, of our customer base, you know, really getting them in. They were interested in what we were doing, and then as we grew and we could fill more of the needs that they had, you know, I think we've got, we had 7,000-8,000 people on the newsletter list at one time. I ended up taking some of them off last year, you know, the ones that weren't active or whatever. But still, that's kind of the core of our customer base, is really people that sign up for our e-newsletter.
I remember, in fact, before the interview, we were looking over your bookshelf, and I happened to see Farm Marketing from the Heart by Charlotte Smith, who's been on the podcast. The number one thing that she said that most farmers make that mistake in is they don't capture that email information. That is really the first way that you start to develop that relationship. You continued the relationship after that initial, I looked at your website, or I saw you at the farmer's market, or I stopped in at the store and I thought it was great. I see in the store, you've got another thing that says, here, sign up for our newsletter, which is great.
Right. And that's actually, I was kind of surprised by how many people actually do sign up for the newsletter in the store. Speaking of, you know, Farm Marketing from the Heart, we bought that, I think Ann and I bought that book probably maybe early this year. And I'd heard great things about it. You know, Joel Salatin was out there, you know, saying, hey, you guys should be, you know, everybody should be reading this book and taking our courses. So I bought the book. I'm more of a reader, you know, that's, you know, I'm a learner by reading stuff and researching stuff. And so I read it, and, you know, what she's advocating, we're sort of doing a lot of that. I mean, I picked up a lot of ideas for how we could be doing that better. I mean, we don't engage people when they sign up right away. They just get a simple, you know, thanks for signing up our newsletter list, but they're not going to get anything from us until I send a newsletter out. And I know there's better ways to handle those new prospects, and we certainly have some room to improve there.
Well, and another thing that I think is really cool about the store is that you have, along with the thing about books, is that you do sell books in the bookstore, which I think is pretty awesome, because and they're books that deal relevantly with what you're selling. They talk about food. They talk about why you raise food the way you do and how to cook that food, most importantly.
Correct. Yeah, so we got into that, I think probably maybe it was 2 years ago. And, you know, so I put out a few of my favorite books, the ones that are like Pasture Perfect by Joe Robinson. And then we also got some copies of Eating on the Wild Side, which is another book that she wrote, which is really awesome. It's all about vegetables and produce. Have you read that
one? I haven't read that one.
Oh, I highly recommend that. In fact, I read that. I think she came out with that probably in 2015. In fact, I remember I went to the Acres Conference and she was there signing the books, and I got her to sign it.
Oh, that's always awesome.
And I had a chance to chat with her, and I said, you know, just so you know, you built my business with your website. You know, pretty much, I don't think I would be here farming if I hadn't got listed on Eat Wild, and she was a wonderful woman. And but that eating on the wild side was really looking at the nutrient values of, like, for example, there's all these different varieties of tomatoes, and she actually, there's a lot of data out there, so she kind of aggregated this data that was out in the world. And like the tomatoes that you buy, you know, even the organic ones that are bred for shipping durability and, you know, they don't have a whole lot of nutrients in them, but the, you know, some of the older varieties, obviously the heirloom varieties, if you raise them in soil, I mean, it's, it's like night and day. And so that's really the focus of that book is like which varieties of tomatoes, you know, asparagus, green beans, and how to cook them or store them to preserve the maximum nutrient value. So great book. In fact, I was giving it to all my, that was like everybody's Christmas gift that year was a copy of that book.
Doing what your sister did.
Yes, exactly. I sent her a copy. but great, great, great book. And so we started selling that in the store. And then we're like, oh, people really like these books. So we started sourcing other books like, you know, Grass-Fed Gourmet. And and we had one, you know, well, Nasha Winters, you know, her her book, Metabolic Approach to Cancer is there. That's a big seller. There's a cheese making book because we sell raw milk. A lot of our customers want to make cheese out of it, so we, those have been popular. So, so it's really been, we've got probably 15 titles that we carry now in the store, and I'd like to carry more if we just had more room. Obviously, the space is limited. We've got them all over the place.
You know what? That's the thing. But you know what? That's the nice thing about books is that I could personally say from my own collecting, there's never enough space for enough books.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay.
So then, what? You sell raw milk. What do you have to do in the state of Illinois to sell raw milk? I know when we talked to Charlotte, it was that you can only have three cows. You thankfully are able to have more than three cows.
Yes. Yes, it's a little different. So it's that's kind of an interesting history. When I first started, you know, even how I got into raw milk, because when I first kind of laid out my plan for the farm, you know, after reading all of Joel Salatin's books and You Can Farm, I was like, oh, we're going to be like a Joel Salatin mini farm in Illinois.
Yeah.
So we're going to do grass-fed beef and pasture pork and poultry. And raw milk was not even on my radar screen. So, but really probably early in 2012, after we got on Eat Wild and our website became more popular, I started getting emails from people. And, oh, I see that you have grass-fed beef. Do you have raw milk? And I'm like, no, sorry, we don't milk any cows. And so it was weird. Within the probably the 2 weeks, I got 30 emails from people wanting raw milk. And I was like, wow, what is this whole thing about raw milk? I mean, I'd never had raw milk. I wasn't really familiar with the benefits of raw milk. So I started doing some research. And, you know, I got a better understanding of whether the health benefits of raw milk. I looked at some other farms selling it. There really wasn't too many options in the Chicago market for raw milk.
There really aren't, which is surprising.
Yeah, I mean, most of the raw milk being consumed is coming in from out of state, from either Wisconsin or from Indiana, and there's drop points, and people would meet behind the Whole Foods and, you know, covertly and, you know, be exchanging, you know,
deals.
Getting the white stuff, you know. so, you know, I saw, wow, there's some places selling it for $10 a gallon, and again, I had zero knowledge of dairy farming. But I'm thinking, how difficult can it be? You know, I'm kind of a risk taker to milk a couple of cows, right? So I watched some YouTube videos. I went down and visited South Pork Ranch, was Keith and Donna, which were one of the few that were offering raw milk. And they're about 2 hours south of Chicago. And they were kind enough to let me hang around for like a morning and watch the milking and, you know, ask a lot of bug the crud out of them questions. And then I'm like, ah, you know, I really would like to do this just to try it out. I'm thinking I'm going to go buy a couple of cows. I really wanted Guernsey cows. I had done enough research. I was read about A2 milk. I don't know if you're familiar with
A2. Yes, I'm very familiar with it, actually.
So I wanted the Guernseys not only for the A2 milk, but also because of the higher butterfat content and, you know, just the more nutritious, richer milk that they produce. And so, but they're not easy to find. I really looked for probably 2 months. Finally got a lead, interesting enough, from Dave Campbell.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So you know Dave. He's, you know, I was buying hay from Dave, and I was actually down there loading some hay on my trailer, and he mentioned, oh, you know, my dad used to breed Guernseys. And I mentioned I was looking for Guernsey cows. And I said, oh, he goes, yeah, he's retired now, but he might know some people. So he gave me his dad's number. I called his dad, Ralph, great guy. He's in his 80s. This is probably a testament to, you know, drinking raw milk and living the good life on the farm, because he's out there throwing the hay bales down to me, and I'm like, I want to be like that when I'm in my 80s, yes. You know, like I'm throwing hay bales around like nothing, mm-hmm. You know, and I was like, that's a good life. But anyway, he knew this guy up in Wisconsin that had just like 10 Guernseys, and he was selling his herd, and he was going to sell us 10 Guernseys. Mm-hmm. And that was really the basis for our herd. So I went up there, I bought two of them, and I bought a little portable milking, bucket milking machine, watched the video on how to use it. Interesting story. Again, I had never milked a cow in my life. So I went and got the two cows. One of them, one of them was Custard, and she was in, you know, producing milk. And then he sold me this heifer that was getting ready to calve. He said, oh, probably in a month or so. And she had this huge udder, and I didn't know enough to say, wow, that's probably going to be a problem. But he said, oh, yeah, and she's bred to an Angus bull, so you'll have a beef calf out of that, you know. And I'm like, all right, sure. So I picked her up, brought him back, and I think I got back like at 4:30 in the afternoon. It was like a 3-hour drive there, 3-hour back. And I'm like, oh, I got to milk this cow because, you know, she's got a full udder. And so I took her into my little horse barn where I kind of figured I was just going to chain her up to the wall, right? Uh-huh. And then, you know, I would start milking her. Well, she would have none of it. You know, she was like moving all around. Of course, she wasn't in a stanchion or anything, so I really couldn't keep her from wiggling all over. And I couldn't get the milk machine on her. You know, I tried for like an hour, and she was having no part of it. So I'm like, oh, my God. So I let her go out, and, you know, she's eating the grass and enjoying the pasture. And I remember going to bed that night. And I was thinking, wow, how stupid am I? You know, how did I get myself? I got these cows. I don't know how to handle dairy cows. I've never milked a cow in my life. And she's going to go dry now because I haven't milked her. She's going to get mastitis. I mean, I knew enough about that. So I got up. I tossed and turned all night. I'm thinking, maybe I can sell the cows. Maybe I can sell them and get my money back. Sell the milking machine. So I went out the next morning, and of course, now she's really full of milk. She hasn't been milked all night, and she stood there like a stone while I milked her, and she gave me like 8 gallons of milk. I mean, she was so full. And I'm like, oh, this isn't so bad, you know. So anyway, that was kind of my auspicious beginning to milking, that took off so fast. We had probably, I think, I'd lined up like 15 customers into a sort of a herd share program. They'd already pre-purchased shares of the cow, which was enough for me to buy the cows and actually afford the milking machine. Mm-hmm. And they paid it up front. And so it's kind of funny. I found a really old sheet from that first year of who our customers were. And we've still got probably half of those customers of those 15 still with us. Like that was summer of 2012. Mm-hmm. So that milk, you know, again, I went back to the guy a month later and bought two more of his cows. And then I went back the next year and bought, like, you know, he still had a few heifers that he was raising. So that his cows formed the basis for our herd. And they were really, really good milking cows, you know, production cows. And so we've got 30 cows now. But, you know, that was the beginning of the milk. And that brought so many customers to us. Sometimes I wonder if we hadn't had the raw milk, mm-hmm. bringing that cash, steady cash in year-round, that I don't know if we'd still be farming, because, you know, when it got tight, we knew we could always count on that milk money from those herd share customers, mm-hmm. To kind of keep us going. But at the time, from a regulatory perspective, it was kind of a gray zone. There was no rules for or against raw milk in Illinois, unlike a lot of other states.
Yes, Wisconsin is an absolutely wretched state for anyone that wants to sell raw milk.
I called a few people. I called the state. They said, oh, well, there is no rules, but right now there's kind of an accepted way of doing it, which is mm-hmm. that customers have to come to the farm where the cows are milked. They have to bring their own container, mm-hmm. and you can't advertise it, whatever that means. Like, what's advertised? You mean I can put a sign? You can't put a sign up? Or, you know, so there was, mm-hmm. and that was all that there was. And so I said, oh, okay, well, I can abide by those rules. And then I'm like, well, if I put it on my website, is that advertising it? You know, it was kind of loosey goosey. There was, mm-hmm. you know, there was milk coming in from other states. There was people. I soon met lots of people that were selling raw milk, you know, and they were sort of maybe following the rules. Some were dropping it off in places. And so I was like, I think we're fine. I'm following the rules. And so for about a year, everything was good. And then I heard from Donna O'Shaughnessy that there was this committee that had been formed by the Department of Public Health to form some clear regulations for raw milk in Illinois. Mm-hmm. And she says, who's on the committee but like the FDA and Dean Foods and the Illinois Farm Bureau?
Exactly who you want to be on that kind of a board.
Nobody from that actually produces or drinks raw milk was on the committee.
And funny how it works that way.
So she said, you know, we got to get some farmers onto this committee. And so I said, I'll volunteer to be on the committee. She was on the committee. The Bogues from Golden Guernsey, Illinois, got on the committee. There was probably like five of us farmers that joined this committee. And we just said, hey, we want to get on. And we actually, some of my customers are still with me. We also got them on the committee. And so we had, I think probably over the course of 2 years, we had about 8 to 10 meetings. Sometimes we'd... And we go down to, you know, Springfield or Champaign, and we'd have these meetings with usually be 2 or 3 people from the Illinois Department of Public Health. And I would say they really wanted to craft some rules that we could all live by. Like, they were not in any way saying we want to shut down. We just want to control it. We want to make sure that it's safe. It's safe for people, that consumers know what they're getting. And so really they went into it, I think, with – you know, very legitimate concerns, and they wanted to. There was an FDA guy. He only showed up probably for the first year, and he was definitely wanting it to be more strict, like really to make sure that nobody could meet the regulations.
Of course.
But he dropped off, and along the way, I would say Illinois Stewardship Alliance was helping us, you know, organize around the meetings and keeping us abreast of, you know, any behind the scenes stuff that they heard going on. And at the same time, we were having probably monthly conference calls with the Farm-to-Consumer...
Legal Defense Fund.
Legal Defense Fund. And so Pete Kennedy was on those calls all the time, and he was like, all right, you know, here's what we need to do. So I would say without those two organizations, we probably wouldn't have had the same outcome. And eventually we got to the point where they said, all right, the meetings are over. We're going to draft the rules now. And, you know, we went back and forth multiple times. They were going to put restrictions on how many cows you could have, how much milk you could produce, could you sell it in a farmer's market or not. You know, there was a lot of stuff that we talked about. And we got a draft, an early draft, and we didn't really like, there were some things in there that were kind of onerous. So I actually had an interesting opportunity to meet with the director of the Illinois Department of Public Health, who has an office in Chicago.
Yeah.
Three of us farmers and went down and we met with him in his office. And he was actually in favor of raw milk. He was of Indian descent. This was Governor Rauner's appointment to the position. So he was a microbiologist and a lawyer, very sharp guy. And he's like, you know, hey, I want to make this workable for you. I'm not against raw milk. I just want to make sure consumers know what they're getting and that they're buying raw milk. And there's a risk to it. And that we can make sure we have a safe supply. And we're like, that's perfect. We want to make sure of that as well.
Yeah.
And so he actually, I thought he was on our side. He said, who's opposed to it? Is your Cook County health commissioner, your Will County health commissioner. He said it's the local health departments that do not want raw milk.
Yes.
And he says, and they have a lot of political clout in Springfield. They have all these Cook County state representatives and stuff that have clout. He says, so that's who I'm battling. I'm really kind of on your side. So we took advantage of that. His help with us getting it through. In fact, I brought him some raw milk when I went down there in his office.
Not overt bribery.
No, exactly. But at any rate, so they came out with the rules in 2016, and we had 6 months essentially to comply with the rules. I think we had until July of 2016. So so they came out and inspected us. We have to sample our own milk. So I had to get a sampler's permit. So I had to be a certified sampler to sample my own milk. And then I usually run it up to the lab. There's only like 3 accredited labs that we can use, and one of them is in Monroe, Wisconsin. So it's about an hour and a half drive. So sometimes if I'm going to go that way, I'll just drop off a milk sample with them. But you can ship it to them as well. But I found that if I drop it off as soon as I get it out of the cow, my chances of having everything come clean are good, you know. So it was kind of tough because we had to have 4 samples. And they're looking at coliforms, antibiotic residue, which, you know, we know that we're not going to have that. And then bacteria count and somatic cell count.
Yes.
And really the one that's hard to hit is the coliform number because it's 10 or less CFUs, you know, per milliliter. And that's, you know, it's weird. Sometimes I'll take my milk sample in and it'll be 0. And then another time it'll be 50.
Oh, wow.
And we're going through the same process. We're cleaning the cows the same way every day. We're cleaning the tank. But that's the hard number for people to hit. And that's the only one that we usually ever miss on. Is that coliform number. So, but we got the permit. We send a sample in once a month now. They only ever inspected us once.
Oh, wow.
And I guess that's part of the regulations is they don't have to do an annual inspection or anything like that. They just inspect you once. So I would say it's a little challenging getting it once you have it, as long as you're taking your milk samples in. You know, it's actually pretty easy to keep it. You did notice the big sign we had to post above the milk tank.
Yes.
And 2-inch letters that, yes. You know, this is dangerous and could cause illness and all that. So there's some other requirements. We have to have the sign there. We have to keep a log form. So everybody that buys raw milk, every time they come in, they have to fill out this log mm-hmm. form.
That I thought was pretty interesting because yeah. I asked.
Yeah.
First of all, you have to keep it for 6 months.
Yep.
And it's like, oh, wow, look at all those papers from 6 months. And I'm like, oh, no, that's just since January.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of, I mean, we have a lot of customers, and they're filling this out every time they come in.
Mm-hmm.
Their name, address, phone number, how much milk they got. So we've never had them come back and ask for those.
Mm-hmm.
But we keep them for 6 months, and then we just shred them.
Yeah.
So those are, for new customers, we have a little milk fact sheet, raw milk fact sheet mm-hmm. that we have to give them if this is the first time they're buying milk. Just a little one pager.
Yeah.
But other than that, really, it's not too terribly challenging. You know, I would say, you know, the dairy operation is by far the most complex and challenging to learn, and managing the health issues of the dairy cows is very different than beef cows. You know, the
yes.
beef. No, that's like super low maintenance. I never have any health issues with my beef
yes.
cows. With the dairy cows, it's like just an ongoing, you know, mm-hmm. if somebody's limping today or mm-hmm. somebody's got a cyst or somebody's got mastitis. It's really weird, you know, the different ways that these animals have, you know, been bred over the years. The dairy mm-hmm. cows obviously to produce a lot of milk.
Yes.
And the beef very hardy and to be super low maintenance.
Yeah.
You know, our goal at some point is to we're taking our best cows, you know, which mm-hmm. really came from that initial herd
yeah.
and breeding them, and we have their offspring, and now we've got some of their offspring, other offspring, and really to, I'm hoping at some point that we can have a herd that's really genetic. I don't really care if they produce a ton of milk. I just want it to be really good quality milk, but them to be, you know, really hardy animal.
Yeah, a healthy, low
yeah,
maintenance
exactly,
animal,
yeah.
which I'm from Wisconsin. Obviously, Holsteins are the number one thing out there. We've
right.
bred Holsteins to the point where they only produce lots of milk.
Exactly.
And they have like zero resistance to anything else. You look at them wrong and they just yeah. want to die.
Right, right.
This is what happens when we manipulate the genetics of an animal too mm-hmm. much. And it's really nice to see that you're focusing mm-hmm. on the health aspect and not how much milk can I get out of this creature.
Right, right. Yeah. And I would say, you know, because we, again, you know, I would say I had a steep learning curve, you know, because mm-hmm. I came from zero background. I'm thinking, wow, it would be great if I grew up on a dairy farm. I would know a lot of this stuff already. But, you know, so we've kind of learned on the fly and made a lot of mistakes. You know, we've had our problems getting them bred.
Mm-hmm.
You know, early on we had an elderly gentleman that was, I would say he was probably in his 80s, and he was breeding the cows, doing artificial insemination. And, you know, he was an awesome guy. He would come out whenever I called him. But he was getting a little shaky. And then he passed away a couple of years ago. In fact, I say he was here 3 weeks before he passed away breeding one of our cows. So he was, I mean, he was working right till the end. I respect
that.
That's
what you that. Do yeah, when you're
exactly.
an old farmer.
Yeah, yeah. And then, so we had a bull that we raised out of our best cow, and she's out of our best original cow that we got from, you know, from Wisconsin. So we thought, all right, well, let's raise this bull and we'll use him mm-hmm. as our herd bull. And actually, once he got to hang with it, it worked out great. He eventually got, we put him in, he was young. He was probably a little too young. He was only like 18 months old.
He was
old.
A little confused by these feelings.
Yeah, exactly. And he wasn't quite big enough to really get on some of the bigger cows, right? You know, but he grew into the job
mm-hmm.
and he wasn't aggressive. You know, I never felt like he was going to charge anybody, you know. And
yeah.
We just left him with the herd. He was with
mm-hmm.
them. He would come into the parlor, you know, or come into the waiting area and so he got to be kind of a pain, and then we ended up having one of the cows that I think he was mounting her, and he crushed her. He was getting
yeah.
big, and she was kind of a smaller cow. And
when
she,
they get too heavy.
She, and we never had this. It took a couple of days for her where she wasn't walking, and then she couldn't get up. And mm-hmm. I think so after that, we decided that it was time that we'd move on. So Ann and I both took the artificial insemination class.
Yeah.
And so now for the last six, actually it's been a year now, we've been breeding the cows, and so our track record is not great. We're hoping to improve. So but that's part of the learning experience, you know. We're trying to get them all bred, and you know, so we'll get there eventually.
Fun fact, that is why we are the intellectual agrarian, not the agrarian intellectual. I knew where farmers would be thinking of AI versus IA.
Right, right.
So you're located in the Chicagoland area, in kind of towards the edge of it, the suburbs.
Right.
Land access, how do you get enough land to continue growing? Because the main thing is you are a grass-based, pasture-based system.
Right.
Which means you need acres for your cattle, for your chickens, for your hogs, for the turkeys.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
For the lambs. How have you continued to grow with more land?
Sure. So, as I mentioned, we had that 8 acres behind our house, which kind of was really good to have a start. So early on, it gave me an opportunity to kind of play around with things. We had a few acres of woods. So the first year we raised the pigs in the woods there. We had the beef there. We had a couple of dairy cows. We had some chickens. So really the 8 acres was fine for that. But once I started getting all those orders, I'm like, oh, I got to get some more pasture land. And so I was really lucky that my neighbor, who lived right next to me, owned some farmland. And this wasn't land that he owned, but he said, oh, you know, there's that 600-acre, what was called the Duda property at the time, which was kind of controversial because this developer bought this land in Barrington Hills, mm-hmm. and he wanted to put a golf course on it, and the village wouldn't let him because he wasn't going to have 5 acres per house. And so he went into this long battle with the village of Barrington Hills trying to get this golf course, and then developed, and he was trying to take that out of the village into unincorporated, you know, McHenry County. And so anyway, there was this 600 acres sitting there, and it had been originally part of this organic beef farm until he bought it. And so they were doing corn and beans on a corn and beans. You know, he was just renting it out. Well, there was this little corner of it, which was 40 acres. Half of it was woods and half of it was pasture. It had a little shelter on it, and it was never big enough really for the tractor to get in there, and he would have had to take the fences down. So that was always leased out to another guy who was doing livestock there. Well, we took it over. He said, so I just sublet that from the farmer for $200 an acre. It was really cheap. And it already had water, and it had a little shed, and it had some rundown fencing. We had to repair the fencing. But essentially, it was super easy for me to start moving my cattle over there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that gave us, and then those 40 acres of woods were perfect, or the 20 acres of woods were perfect for the pigs. So we moved the beef over there the first year, and I think the pigs over there the second year. And so that really kind of bridged the gap for a couple of years. We had that extra land. The only thing we still had at the house was the dairy cows, because, of course, we had to milk the cows in the little barn. We had a little horse barn, a little two-stall horse barn, and so I built some wood stanchions in there, and we would milk one with the bucket milker, while the other one we'd clean and prep them. And so that was kind of how we did it, which were great when you had 2 cows or 4 cows or then 6 cows, and then we had 8 cows, and then we had 10 cows. And now I'm like, wow, this is taking a long time. And literally people would come to get their milk out of the barn. It was kind of a self-serve thing, and the cows would be grazing. Part of the rotation was our backyard, you know, so I never had to mow the backyard for those few years that we had.
Brilliant.
So there's pictures of the cows standing right next to our screened-in porch, you know. We'd be out there having dinner, and the cows would be, you know, laying right next to the porch.
Looking at the steak you're
exactly.
eating.
So I knew that we needed, like, a real dairy barn. I really mm-hmm. needed a pasture, you know, so we could really grow the milk operation. And so I started looking around, and I'm like, well, it needs to be something close to the house. And, you know, where we're at now, this current farm, my house is about 10 minutes away. And so mm-hmm. I used to drive by here all the time.
Oh, really?
Yes. I drive by this, I go into the mall or whatever, I drive by this farm, and I was like, wow, that's just a beautiful farm, you know, with the big red, mm-hmm. old red barn. And it was always meticulously maintained. It was owned by the Bruner family.
Mm-hmm.
And they had, when the elder Bruner, and they were not farmers, they had acquired, I think this is 740 acres that they had acquired from like 5 or 6 dairy farms over the years, starting in the 60s. And it had this frontage on the Fox River, so it's got about 3 miles of frontage on the Fox River. So this land was very valuable. And when Frank Bruner was getting close to death, he said, you know, I don't want this to be developed, because, of course, everything around here has been developed. And this would have been condos and townhouses, right?
Yeah.
So he sold it to the King County Forest Preserve in 2008. And it was the biggest land purchase money-wise they'd ever made, because it wasn't like he gave it to him.
Yeah.
He sold it to him for $42 million. So if you do the math, that's like, you know, pretty expensive per acre land here, right?
Yeah.
So the Forest Reserve bought it, and they didn't do anything with it for several years. I mean, they didn't put a parking lot in here. There was no walking trails or anything. Mm-hmm. But I would drive by, and I could see that, you know, they tore down some of the buildings. They did not, fortunately, tear down the beautiful red barn, but I could see that it had these huge holes in the roof. I'm like, oh, man, that would be a perfect place to milk cows. And instead of growing corn, because this field up front, mm-hmm. which is our front pasture, was corn and beans every year. And I said, oh, I wonder if they'd be interested. So I approached the Kane County Forest Reserve. This is probably in 2013. Mm-hmm. I think it was 2013. And I wrote them a letter and said, oh, would you be interested in subletting, you know, renting me some of the land there? And then, you know, we would use the barn. And I didn't hear from them. So then I called, didn't hear from them. And finally, they agreed to meet me out here. And they said, oh, well, you fixed up this barn. I'm like, well, it is your barn, but, you know, they say, oh, we got an estimate to fix the roof and the foundation. It's going to be $200,000. I'm like, wow, I don't think I have that laying around. We started the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And after a couple of the commissioners, the county board commissioners, who were also the Forest Preserve commissioners, they serve a dual purpose. They came to visit our other farm, and they were really interested in, you know, the cows on the grass and the chickens and the pigs, and they say, okay, I think we could do this there. But I told them I have to have a store here. We got to be able to sell the stuff that we produce, and so that was part of the lease arrangement. So it took a couple of years, really, from me approaching them to us actually finally getting on the property, which was in 2015. And I would say it's been a very good relationship. You know, they've been very supportive. We're way out of the box. They have probably 5,000 acres that they lease to farmers, but all those are growing hay, mm-hmm. corn, or soybeans on that land.
Yeah.
And they're just renting it, you know, until the Forest Preserve wants to do something with it, you know. So in this case, we said, I need a long-term lease because we're going to be putting a lot of money into the barn.
It's a lot of investment.
It's a big investment. We're building fences. We're going to fix up that little garage and turn it into a store. And so we knew that we would have to invest a lot of money. I said, I need a 25-year lease. They're like, oh, we've never done a 25-year. So what we ended up doing was it renews every 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
But if they were to terminate it at any point in the first 10 years, then they have to pay us back for all the investments we've made in it.
That's a good arrangement.
So that worked out pretty well. But I would say they've been very supportive of it. Part of the reason, and I probably was a little generous, is we give them a percentage of our store sales.
Oh, wow.
So I wanted them to be on board with us.
No wonder they're really supportive. Yeah,
exactly. So that percentage has gotten to be a significant sum now, and so I'm trying to renegotiate that part of it because we're having to put a lot of money into the buildings. You know, mm-hmm. We need to repaint the barn.
Yeah.
You know, we put a new roof on this. We put, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know if you've noticed how nice these things. We put a new well in. We've put a lot of money into the property, and so mm-hmm. That percentage is taken away from our ability to continue to, you know,
invest in
it. Yeah, exactly. So, but like I said, they've been very supportive. They bring other Forest Preserve people here and say, oh, look what we've done. You know, they show us off to other
people.
You guys
are the bragging point.
Yes, yes.
Wisconsin Forest Preserve, look what we've done.
Right. We got this something kind of neat. And in fact, they brought McHenry County Conservation District here.
Oh.
And so that's how I started talking to them about maybe leasing some property from them, mm-hmm. you know, as we need, because we definitely need more pasture for beef.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're really limited in what we can produce here. And so that's, and we're probably going to be close to maxing out how much milk production we can have a year. And so I wouldn't mind maybe producing milk at another location where we could also have the store. And so we're looking at a property in the city, McHenry, where that Peterson Park, I've talked to them about maybe potentially, mm-hmm. they have an old barn there, beautiful barn. That's actually more ready to go than this one. We could just probably put in a pipeline and be milking cows in there in a week.
Wow.
And that's right off of 31 too, and down right around the main shopping area in McHenry. So,
mm-hmm.
So we're having a dialogue with them, you know, that's a possibility. So I think really having this here and be able to show this to other, you know, landowners. But I think our total advantage, like, or really the reason we've been successful, I think, is because we're in a high population area.
Mm-hmm.
Customers can get to us easily. They can drive by. We do a lot of, in the summer, we do weekly guided farm tours. You put everyone in a hay wagon and drive them around to the pastures. We have walking trails around here, and so we're putting up some maps and signs like, here's the pigs are this way, and the beef cows are this way, uh-huh. and the chickens are this way, you know, so people can kind of do a self-guided tour around the farm, even if we're not, you know, having somebody, you know, able to take them into the pastures, what have you. So having kind of that, you know, community, where I would almost call it like a community farm where people can come.
Yeah.
And see the animals and see what we're doing and get a better sense for where their food's coming from, I think makes a big difference.
It does, because so many of us are disconnected from our food. I was so horrified when I went to the zoo with my family one day and found that they had a cow in the zoo. Why, in Wisconsin, of all places, would you have a cow in a zoo? Now, I'll give them credit. It wasn't a Holstein. If it was a Holstein, I would have just broken down right there in the zoo. It was a belted Galloway, actually, of all things. But still, we are that disconnected from our food. So having a place where the people can come and see their food grown is amazing and is awesome. I'm just a little curious. Have you guys done any soil tests to, like, see how... I'm assuming that the ground has improved since it was just corn and beans, different places.
For sure. What we did was the first year we did take some baseline soil tests. And part of what we were interested in doing is seeing, okay, what's going to happen when we get perennial pasture under these? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is prime farmland. I mean, this is grade A farmland that we've got here. But, of course, it's been farmed for 100 years, probably close to 100 years now that it's been farmed continuously. And so... So we did take, like, the beef pasture and the dairy pasture, and I think we took some of the vegetable field. I'll have to pull my soil book out. But I did take a baseline, you know, for example, in the beef pasture. And I look at organic matter as a big indicator, you know, of how productive the soil can be, and that was at 2%. and then we tested it again this year after 2 years. So we planted that pasture in 2016, so it's actually been 3 years now that we've been rotationally grazing, and pretty much the exact same spot. I pulled a soil sample last fall, and the organic matter was up to 3.9.
Wow.
So that's in 3 years. We almost doubled the organic matter in that beef pasture, and that's also where we run the broiler chickens back and forth over that. And then the dairy pasture, actually the turkey, what we primarily look at is our turkey pasture up front here, and that was up at 6.9% organic matter.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's crazy how quickly you can rebuild that soil organic matter and the soil health readings, because we get a kind of a composite reading.
Mm-hmm.
When I first tested what is the beef pasture now, we were like, it's, they give you a number, I think, 1 to 25, and it was low. It was like 3. And now it was higher than 25. So I don't know how their rating scale works, but it was off the charts. And that was, they used the Haney test to kind of measure the microbiological activity, you know, it's a respirator, how many microorganisms are respiring and living in the soil, right? Mm-hmm. So it's been really, I would say, enlightening to see how quickly you can turn around worn out farm soil with rotational grazing. So we really, we like to talk about that when people say, well, you know, because we do get some pushback. Oh, you know, you got these smelly animals here, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I've got 30, 40 cows on 60 acres, so, that, you know, you're not going to smell them, you know, unless you're hanging around where they're at in wintertime. But, you know, we do get a little pushback, and I like to be able to say, well, guess what we're doing for the soil, and guess what we're doing for the environment. Plus, you know, all that pasture, if that's in corn and beans, every year that's an annual crop. And all that topsoil was rolling right into the Fox River, along with whatever chemicals were on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, guess what? We're not losing any topsoil. We're rebuilding topsoil now, and there's no chemicals on it. So, I mean, it's a win-win, really. And I think that's why the Forest Preserve is pretty excited. In fact, they've got another grazing trial they're doing on another property, you know, to start. They understand the benefits of it, and so they're sort of trying to pitch it to their constituents, you know. But... they catch a little heat from the conventional farmers. Like, why are you renting that prime land to those, you know, those cow operators? Or, you know, I think it's just a different mentality.
It really is. I do a lot of work in, as an organic inspector, in just guys that are coming straight out of the corn and bean mentality into organics, and there is quite a culture shock to them that first year. They're like, what do you mean crop rotation? Right. It's corn and beans, isn't it?
Yeah, that's my rotation. I rotate, yeah.
So it's always a conversation.
Yeah.
Now, wrapping things up here, Cliff, what is your favorite cut of beef? I'm just always curious to ask people this, especially when you raise it.
Right,
you have
right.
more invested in it. Yeah. You derive some satisfaction.
It's interesting. You know, the great thing about having your own farm is, you know, like every night we take home, you know, milk and eggs and beef and pork, and we eat really well. I mean, and if we got vegetables, we're eating our vegetables. You know, we don't have those year round, but I really, really like skirt steak.
Oh, yes.
So I'm a big skirt steak fan, even though that's not obviously one of the prime cuts. But a lot of times we, like Ann and I, will do a stir fry, and I love just the texture of the stir fried skirt steak is something. But I would say, you know, from the steaks, you know, I like a ribeye, so I'm a big fan of the ribeyes. But you know what? I eat a lot of beef. I'm not a huge chicken eater. You know, I'll eat our chicken, only our chicken.
Well, yeah, it's painful when you know what good chicken tastes like.
I know. I cannot eat that.
Oh,
you know,
it's painful. Yeah. It really is.
Yeah. So I eat our chicken mostly in the summer. I'm like, it's a summer meal. We'll do a lot of beer can chicken, which I think is the best way to fix chicken. You know, it's perfect. But we eat a lot of pork. Hometown sausage, I'll put it in a plaque. Man, they are the best sausage makers out there. And so we've really tried to shift as much of our production up to them because they do such a great job on all the different sausages they make. The kielbasa, you know, I eat a lot of that in the wintertime. But so, yeah, we eat well. That's one of the advantages. And, you know, I go to the grocery store and I never have to buy meat. Or milk, or eggs, you know.
You mean the things that most people go to the store
exactly,
for.
Exactly, right. So, yeah, that's one of the benefits. And you know, we enjoy it. I mean, you know, a lot of people would ask me, you know, what's your favorite part of farming? And I would tell, you know, I tell you, there's nothing like the feeling of moving. It's either the cows or the chickens or the pigs. Once you open up that fresh paddock and they spread out there and they're waiting there in anticipation, you know, by the fence.
Yes.
You know, and once you pull open that gate and they all spread out and they just go run around looking for all the best stuff to eat, it's just, it's very gratifying, you know. And I, unfortunately, as we got bigger and now we have a full-time staff and I have to do more office work.
The whole reason I
wanted to get out of the office work business, you know. It's hard. I got to try to find somebody to do all the office work so I can spend more time outside. But those are the gratifying times, and, you know, and especially on a nice day. You know, it's not always fun when it's like we had the polar vortex and it's 30 below zero and you're going outside trying to get the chickens watered.
Oh, look, I've got some office work to do. Yeah, exactly. Lucas, go do that.
Exactly. That's usually when you'll find me in the office on those days. you know, it's gratifying. You know, it's. I like to think of this as all my years in business, but this is the ultimate entrepreneurial activity because we can decide if I want to, you know, raise turkeys this way or I want to do this. I mean, really, there's so many possibilities, you know, of terms even of our, you know, we keep kind of like, what's our next? I mean, we're really growing, and so it's kind of like, well, how do we keep going? You know, we need more land. Should we open another store somewhere? You know, we're going to maybe move the store into this house, which, you know, is on the property. This vacant house, and it has a much bigger garage, so we'd be using another garage, but it'll be bigger. But we'd love to put a butcher shop in there. Like, we have so many people want fresh.
Yes.
And so we're thinking, if we could take a grass-fed beef and a hog and bring them down. Actually, one of our long-term customers is a retired butcher. He goes, I'll do that for 3 days a week. I'll cut up that meat and, you know. So that's kind of probably on the planning horizon maybe for next year or the year after would be to – once we move the store over there in a commercial kitchen where we'd like to prepare soups, salads, you know, maybe make a beer can chicken. You know, I don't know if that's legal to sell beer can chicken, but anyway.
Sorry, sir, I need to see your ID.
Yeah, exactly, before you can eat that chicken. You know, a lot of the, I mean, we've relied on kind of our core customers are being, you know, they make things out of raw, really, really good raw product.
Yeah.
But I know a lot of the millennials, you know, probably your generation.
Very sadly, yes.
Aren't so much into cooking. I mean, what I found is they're very conscious of the environmental and humanitarian issues that we, you know, how we raise our animals. They want organic food. They want pasture-raised. They want grass, but they just don't necessarily want to cook it.
So. You know, that is a discussion that – so I recently talked with Brandon Sheard from a Farmstead Meatsmith.
Okay.
And he does on-site butchery. And I asked him kind of like, what do you see as some of the challenges in it? I'm expecting he's like talking regulatory or something. He's like, you know, it's that most people don't know how to cook it.
Yeah.
That's the sad thing. And I understand to a certain degree, I barely cook myself. But granted, that's because I have been very fortunate to be blessed with a mother and sisters who do a great job cooking. So I just show up for dinner instead of having to actually make it myself. But
yeah, I think that's, I mean, that's the challenge that we have, you know, and then this whole issue about delivery. Like, we've struggled for years. Should we deliver stuff? We get all, people call all the time, oh, can you deliver that? And I'm like, well, no, we don't have any delivery, you know. And I like, it's nice, it's easy. Mm-hmm. We make people come to the store. They get a lot of impulse purchases that way. We don't have to logistically deal with any delivery type issues. And I think because we're located so close to our customers, we haven't had to do it. You know, I know a lot of other farms that are farther out that produce really great, high-quality products, but they have to, they either have to deliver, do farmers markets, or they have to wholesale, they have to hustle to get to their customers, and we don't have to do that. So I've struggled with it really over the last year. You know, do we bow to the consumer demand for delivery and start doing delivery, or do we hold to our, you know, well, you got to come to the farm and get it, you know?
Well, you almost have the disadvantage with the raw milk is that before.
Yeah.
I can't
and
remember.
We can't deliver it, actually.
Okay, you can't deliver the raw milk. So, that, see, you do have that, at least, you can say.
We can fall back on that. We say that all the time. State law doesn't allow us to deliver the raw milk. But, you know, so it's one of those issues that I think about, you know, a lot and I wrestle with. And so far, because our sales have been growing so strongly here in the store, we haven't had to do that. You know, we've been fortunate. You know, I know a lot of other farms don't have that luxury, and so they really have to hustle and to get their product to customers. And so I think for at least for now, we're not doing delivery. But and I think if we open the bigger store, we had more floor space, we open the butcher shop. Now I'm thinking, all right, see, these people that want fresh meat as opposed to frozen meat can be coming multiple times a week.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's even more opportunities for us to engage with those customers. And so I think, you know, that's probably where we'll focus our energies over the next year, and then, you know, getting more pasture land. So, yeah, so it's good. It's always challenging, you know, always exciting. But we feel like we're, you know, providing a product. We get such great feedback from our customers. People say, you know, what do you really like about farming? I say, well, you know, all those years in the insurance business, I never once had somebody say, thanks for selling me that insurance policy. I mean, I'm sure some of it was helping them, but usually it was like, it didn't cover this, or, you know, it didn't, you know, you
they
never,
just found complaints.
Right, exactly. It was mostly, and now, I mean, really, you know, especially we've got some customers that have been with us for 6-7 years, and I see them, I know them, you know, I don't know all of them because I'm not in the store all the time, but some of them, you know, I've known for years, and they tell us, oh, this is the best milk I've ever had. I mean, really, we're really known for the milk. People will say, oh, we've never had milk like this before. It's great. You know, we have a lot of European customers, and this is kind of what they grew up on was
That's
raw
true,
milk.
Yeah.
And so it helps having some people that can speak Polish in the store, like Anna and Karolina. That was a strategic move on my part. We have a lot of Polish customers. You know, they tend to be very willing.
It's a culture
of food. They want good food. Right, and they don't mind paying a little extra for good food.
Exactly.
Yeah, so that's really been, you know, gratifying. But just the feedback we get, you know, we've got some customers. I remember one, he's been coming to us for years, and he was really, really overweight. And because I'm not always around the store, he'd come every Saturday morning, and he'd buy a lot of beef from us, and, you know, I would sometimes see him, sometimes not. And then I saw him actually last fall, and I hardly recognized him because he's probably lost like 150 pounds. I'm like, Mike, is that you? And he said, yeah. And he said they ate healthy. They were only eating grass-fed. I mean, he was buying raw milk for years. He still buys raw milk, buys a lot of red meat from us, but he looks, I mean, like a different person. So it's good that, you know, we get the feedback not only that our products are nutritious, but also helping our customers eat, you know, a healthy diet. And, you know, it's a lot of people have chronic health issues that seem to be resolved, especially we hear that on people that are drinking the raw milk. So
that A2 milk makes a difference. I have a couple of siblings that if they drink milk, they have to drink A2 because they have allergies that just make it so that if they drink regular conventional milk, they will be violently ill.
Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah. So you've read the book, The Devil in the Milk?
I haven't yet.
Oh. So the whole book on the whole A2 milk, it's a Australian professor that wrote, I think he's either from Australia or New Zealand, mm-hmm. where they really kind of pioneered the whole A2 research. Yes. But the book is called The Devil in the Milk, and it's Devil about the reaction a lot of people have to A1 milk and how that's kind of been hidden. You know, it's been mm-hmm. not talked about for years and years, even though the data has been out there. So, yeah, that's it's a scientific read. I don't know. It would test your intellectual agrarian mentality, I think.
Over the winter. That's
yes,
a winter read.
Yes, it was heavy for sure. A lot of science, but maybe something you'd be interested in looking at.
Cliff, where can people go to learn more about you and your work?
So, obviously, we have a farm website, you know, allgrassfarms.com. So we've got a lot of information there, really, even about our farming practices. We have a pretty robust... we're going to be putting more videos on. That's one thing we've heard people, give us more farm videos. So we're trying to do that. And so that's probably the best place. And of course, we always invite people to stop by the farm. We do the tours every Saturday at 2 p.m., mm-hmm. starting in May, running through Thanksgiving. There's free tours. Just show up at 2 o'clock, and we'll put you on the hay wagon and take you all around the farm, and you'll get to see all the animals up close.
That's awesome.
Or stop in the store.
Stop in the store. Get yourself some kombucha off the tap.
Yes, yes, that kombucha is good.
Thanks again for being on the show, Cliff.
All right, thanks for having me, T.
Big thanks to Cliff for letting me come and visit the farm and interview him in person. He's got an incredible farm, and it was fantastic to visit. Be sure to check out his farm. You can find links to his website and social media in the show notes. Thanks for listening to the show. If you're new to the podcast, we would love it if you would subscribe on whatever your podcast player of choice is. While you are there, please leave us a review, letting others know how great the show is. Tips on how to do this can be found at intellectualagrarian.com/review. We would also love to send you our top episodes with practical conversations on farming and food in the grocery bag. You can get this sent to your inbox by dropping your email on the bottom of our website where it says, "Subscribe to Cultivate Your Mind." Thanks again for listening. This has been Terrence Lahue and the Intellectual Agrarian Podcast, reminding you to keep farming the dream.